And welcome to Run the Table. I'm your host, Bryce Tinson. Over it. How are we doing?
Doing good.
That's all you're going to give me today?
Yes.
What? Okay, then.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. I just normally you give me a little bit more. I know.
I'm ready to get into it.
Oh, whoa, okay. So today is we're going to take a little bit of break from the combine, although it is happening. As we speak, we will talk a little bit about, you know, some of the things going on. We're just not doing any draft stuff. We're going to save that, the multi draft episodes a week for when we actually get closer to the draft. We got some stuff we got to talk about. Jake Paul, Tommy Fury, Sunday mm-hmm. that they fought? I want to talk about some college basketball. It is March. It is college basketball season. It only happens during March and in the first week of April. That's the only time that college basketball happens. The MLB, I want to talk about the pitch clock. I want to get your thoughts on that. And then obviously, like I mentioned, some NFL combine stuff. There was a lot that happened right after we released our, running back rankings?
Right after, I think, our mock draft on Tuesday.
Oh, no, it was the mock draft. That's right. It was right after the mock draft.
Talking about how Jalen Carter was, like, bona fide to go top three.
Some serious stuff happened. We'll get into all of that. But first, we got to start with your former Golden Boy, Jake Paul.
Yeah. First off, you know, I'm a little bit frustrated we're talking about it. I think it goes into kind of the nature of social media and everyone. It's deathly quiet and almost everything is speculative of, you know, Jake Paul and his wins in the past. But as soon as he loses, everyone who is eerily quiet comes up and loves to talk about Jake Paul. It is what it is. I don't think we talked about the Anderson Silva fight after that happened. But again, it is what it is.
Well, no, because we never talked about Anderson Silva before. You were the biggest Jake Paul supporter I know. So, of course, we're going to talk about it.
Well, we didn't talk about Jake Paul Anderson Silva is what I'm saying.
Wait, they played? They fought?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
But a couple of months ago. But anyway.
How did I miss that?
I don't know. But I think everyone, you know, didn't care until Jake Paul lost. And then, Jake Paul lost. And I bet they didn't do a great job of, you know, advertising that. But
he legitimately didn't even know
it is
what
it is. Look that up. Figure out when it is. No, but listen. Jake Paul, I thought it was a poor decision. I thought it was a draw, in my opinion. I watched bits and pieces of the fight, but I didn't want to spend $50 plus ESPN Plus.
October 29th, 2022.
Yeah. I didn't want to spend $50 plus ESPN Plus to get that fight, so I didn't watch the whole thing, but I watched bits and pieces. But folks, you know, ESPN agrees with me here. I thought it should have been a draw. ESPN did too. One fighter had a knockdown. The other had a lot more punches. That's fine. That's how a lot of Jake Paul fights are. You look at the first Tyron Woodley fight. Paul was outpunched. He won the fight. Why? Because he is a sort of fighter. It's like looking at two hitters and saying, oh, well, Stephen Kwan's average was higher than Aaron Judge's. You know, it's like, that's ridiculous. Aaron Judge hit 50 home runs or whatever, 61 home runs, which is to say Jake Paul is a fighter who's looking for that one or two punches in the entire fight to potentially knock out his opponent or whatever. And obviously, he was even out power punched, and that's true. But even within those power punches, Jake Paul is going to make his money on those big 10 punches or even big five. And that's the difference. It's like Jake Paul's hardest hitting five punches should be and have been in the past, you know, more lethal and deadly than his opponents. And so he's not going to do a lot of damage over the course of the fight just throughout punching and, you know, little by little, like maybe a Floyd Mayweather. But what he is going to do is, hey, you know, I'm going to lower you to sleep with, you know, a couple of shots to the body and then bang, hit you with a knockout in a later round, which he's done a really good job of. And in the later round, he had the only knockdown in the fight. I thought it should have been a draw. That's just me. But having said all of that, and that being my real takeaway from the fight, was these are two equals. But that takeaway in itself kind of shows, if these fighters are equals, you know, what does that say about Jake Paul? You can't be the best if, you know, you're tying with an albeit great fighter and, you know, really talented fighter who has great genetics, obviously, with his brother being one of the greatest boxers of all time, but not the best, you know, and this isn't Canelo. This isn't Floyd. If it was Jake instead of Logan doing that fight, this is a fighter that kind of like Jake is young and a guy that Jake should have beaten on his way to becoming the best fighter of our generation, but he didn't. And I can't even say, oh, I thought he beat him, because I thought it was close and I thought it was about equal. I thought it was a draw. So, listen, I was wrong. I think Jake Paul isn't the greatest fighter of our generation. I took a big swing. In retrospect, I was wrong. You know, I was high on Jake, but I would say 99.9% of boxing commentators, analysts, not even analysts, but people on Twitter, you know, idiots on their cell phones on Twitter talking about how Jake Paul would get knocked out by Ben Askren. And all of those idiots were every bit as wrong as I was, if not twice as much, yeah. Including Mike, who was probably the most wrong about Jake Paul of anyone I met. He literally said on every single fight he was going to lose. Jake Paul is 6-1 now. So he does have the one, though, and he wants everyone to be made sure about that. So listen, it's frustrating. Yes, I was wrong. I think everyone was wrong with a couple of exceptions. I think Joe Rogan was probably hit the nail on the head where he was like, listen, Jake Paul's a really talented young fighter, and he is a real fighter. But he didn't go as far as I did, which is to say that he was the greatest fighter of our generation.
You know, that's kind of what you do, right? You take your things to the extreme.
Otherwise, what's the point? and listen, if I didn't, we wouldn't be talking about this
right now. True. So, it's a good point. It's a good point.
You know, it is what it is. Can he come back? Yeah, sure. But what does that look like? You know, I mean, nobody's going to say.
He's not even in his prime yet.
Yeah, maybe not. But, you know, what does it look like for him to come back? Is it, you know, keeping it close with Canelo, or like, what is it? I don't know. I think he could do better things, and obviously he just had a bad fight, but you know, and I'll also say this, not making any excuses at all, but I do think, you know, I'm sure he negotiates it and he wants it this way, but I think those 3-minute, 8-round fights only disadvantage him, because it's like he's doing the majority of his damage towards the later rounds, and we've seen that in other fights. I don't know why. It's not like, oh yeah, he was running out of gas, and then no, it seemed to me like it was like he was getting better as the fight wore on. I don't know why he doesn't, you know, go for fights that are longer rounds or, you know, more rounds. So that's something that I think he needs to do better at, but you know, hey, he lost. He did lose.
Yeah, I didn't watch. I had prior obligations. Even if I didn't, I probably wouldn't have watched it. Too much money and didn't care enough. You know, it just kind of feels like this is the final domino in the whole Jake Paul thing. Like, there's not going to be any more discussion about him because he has the loss. But we know he's like a solid fighter. So he really, everything about him that made him the topic of discussion is really gone. And this will probably be the last time we talk about him, unless, you know, he pulls off an insane upset against, if he does fight Canelo and he somehow beats him, then we'll talk about him. But like, other than that, feels like the Jake Paul thing has run its course a little bit. I don't know if you would agree there.
Yeah, I think somewhat. I mean, I still feel like it's building up towards a huge fight against a huge name. Not that Tommy Fury isn't, but he really, I mean, he only had fought, I think, 8 or 9 times. So.
Yeah, no, he's fought kind of the same amount of fights, same kind of opponents that Jake did.
I think there will be one more chapter, because I think a lot of the reason where there was intrigue for Jake Paul was what people wanted to see him get knocked the bleep out. He didn't, and he didn't.
He still hasn't.
And he didn't even come close. Down, right? He didn't get knocked down by Tommy Fury, and I don't think he's gotten knocked down, period. People would argue, oh, well, he was up against the ropes. Oh, yeah, breaking news. Fighters can't be up against the ropes in a boxing match. Give me a break. But whatever. Apparently, you know, he was knocked down on the ropes against Woodley, but I don't buy it. He won that fight fair and square. So I think that there is that next step, but after that, yeah, I think it'll be pretty much done, because I mean, listen, folks, he's like 26, 27 already.
Is he really?
I think so.
I thought he was like 24.
Okay, maybe. Look. But he's not getting any younger, so I don't know. But yeah.
Hold on, I'm typing with one hand. Yeah, he's 26. Wow, he's older than I thought he was. Wait, that means Logan's like nearing 30.
Yeah, 27.
Oh, wait, they're only a year apart? Huh? I thought they were further apart. Oh, well. Okay. Like I said, it's March. We're talking some college basketball. We have about four games left in the regular season, I think, roughly speaking. Tournament play will start next weekend. Actually, next week.
Probably one game left in the regular season for most teams.
I think Michigan plays Wisconsin. Purdue plays Wisconsin. And then are they done after that?
So
I thought they had one more.
It's like these games and then like the Saturday games.
Yep. Okay. They have two more games. Two more games left. Purdue is Wisconsin tonight, this being Thursday. And then they play on Sunday against Illinois. And then the regular season's over next week. It's Jover. Next week, I believe Tuesday or Wednesday is the earliest the tournament start. Yep. So we'll start getting some clarification on that. There's a lot of teams that are pretty much locked into the tournament, but there's a race for the first four out, first four in, you know, all those teams. We're going to start with, I want your top four teams right now in college basketball.
Alabama won, and they're insanely deep, especially at that guard position, it feels like. I don't know. I wouldn't put them at one right now, but I think they're certainly up there. Purdue's gone over a really rough patch, but I would still put them up there. I think that, you know, Zach Giddey is pretty much impossible to guard one-on-one. And you have to have a really good interior defender to try and guard him. And even then it becomes difficult, but it's the same story with Purdue. It's like they're kind of tailing off at the wrong time. And they've been doing that for past couple of weeks lately and past couple of years. So it'll be interesting to see how that shapes out. But as far as, you know, teams throughout the season, they are certainly in the top four, and I think they'll get a number one seed. I think Kansas probably has a claim for that. They obviously won the Big 12 regular season, which is undoubtedly the best conference in college basketball. Yep. I think they just have a really good mix of guys that can score and guys that can guard. Grady Dick is a bucket. I think, who is it, like Jalen Wilson or whatever his name is. He's a good scorer and a good player. And then probably Houston would be my last four of the four. They're just, you know, classic, classic team. Just really guard really well. Pretty much same like last year. Don't really know of many of the players, but I've just watched I think a game or two of theirs, and it's the same story as last year. They defend really well, and that translates.
So I do agree with you on Purdue and Kansas and even to some extent Houston. My thing with Alabama, and this is why I think they're eventually going to bite the dust even before the Final Four, is even last night on Wednesday night against Auburn, they're down by like 10 points or 15 points. They somehow find a way to come back in these games, and it is because they can score. I think they're one of the most efficient offenses in the country. But one of those games, like one of those games in the tournament, they're just not going to be able to hit their shot, so they get down early and then they're going to lose. Like this isn't the first time that they've been down. Look at the Oklahoma game. They lost by 32, an Oklahoma team that has, you know, isn't going to make the tournament. So I don't know. They're probably number one, a number one seed, just because they are 26-4 throughout the regular season, but I wouldn't make them my number one overall seed if it's, you know, if we were ranking by confidence. I don't feel confident that team is going to be able to string enough games together to come out on top at the end.
I think part of the thing with Alabama is like the reason why they're able to kind of come back from these games is because it's like they always have one guy that steps up.
Yeah.
And, you know, last night it's like Javon Quinterly, who, you know, has kind of played second fiddle to Mark Sears, goes absolutely off. And, you know, that just propels them to victory because they have four or five insane scoring options and outlets that you can go to. So that will take them pretty far, I think, but we'll see.
So my next question I wanted to get to is, you know, with college basketball this year, back in, was it 2021 when we had Baylor Gonzaga, it felt like all season we were just reaching, we were building up to a point where it was those two teams are going to play in the championship game. Even last year, it was kind of like, okay, well, Kansas was just kind of good the entire year, but nobody really talked about them. This year, it feels like we really don't have a team like that. Why do you think this year, as opposed to years past, is so much more parity? I don't know how you would word that. Why do you think there's so much more parity this year than years past?
Transfer portal helps, and I think that that does seem to, you know, play a factor, and it seems like a lot of teams can be very solid. But I would also say, like, 99% of years we don't have Baylor and Gonzaga. Hardly
ever.
No,
that's a good point.
And I think that a lot of times it's like, it's the nature of college basketball. We watch, we go, you know, however many months of watching college football, and Georgia can absolutely just physically dominate teams. And if they're playing whoever the opponent might be, if it's Sam Houston State or whoever, they can literally physically dominate them. And that is the end of the story. That's the end of the game. In college basketball, you can't do it. It is totally skill-based as much as it is athletic-based. And so if you're not hitting your shots one night and, you know, you're even having an off night from a scoring perspective, like Matt Painter talks about that all the time. He's like, yes, we can beat teams, you know, when we're shooting the ball well, and we can do that. But the important thing will be, can we win games grinding them out 52-50? Can we win games? You know, so I think that is such a huge aspect of college basketball. It's like, it's so hard to win night after night after night when you're playing three times a week, and one of those nights you don't have a, you know, a good shooting night, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, they lost. You know, you can't lose in a week, so they lost. They go down four pegs, and they're a bad team. It's like, it's difficult, you know. And Purdue, they just got done playing IU, and I forget who the other team was that week, but it's like,
was it Northwestern?
I think so, maybe. And you know, it's like, oh, they had two terrible week, but it's like, you're playing IU and Northwestern, it's difficult. And Purdue can't just come out there and just say, we're going to put our, you know, heads down and just absolutely overpower them because we want to win. Well, you can want to win as much as you want. And in football, if you want to win and Alabama's coming off a loss and they say, this is our game, they can be like, hey, as long as we're 110%, we're winning this game. It's not the same. You know, you can be motivated all you want, but if you don't play well, you're going to lose. You're going to get beat. And that's what happened to Purdue. I mean, Purdue got beat by IU twice. I don't know the last time that happened, you know, as a Purdue fan that I can remember. So
last time it happened and Purdue still won the Big Ten was like the 40s.
Wow. Unbelievable. But yeah, I think it's weird. In some conferences, it feels like there's a lot of parity. I've always said, you know, for 5-10 years, I think a huge aspect of it is that, you know, group of five teams or teams not in, you know, power five conferences are really good. Mm-hmm. Teams without football programs or prominent football programs are very good at college basketball because it isn't as much money to fund a basketball program and be competitive at basketball. Yep. Like, it is so much money to be a competitive and field a competitive football program for years. I mean, you look at, you know, how much money like Willie Fritz is making, you know, it's a lot of money. Basketball, you know, you need a couple of good players and decent facilities. I mean, you know, won a tournament game. And, you know, we got to the final 32. It's like, in football, when was the last time we ever have done that? So even last year was a great year. Couldn't win the MAC championship. So it is what it is. But I think a lot of those programs are realizing, like, hey, we can, Wichita State, VCU, you know, all those programs didn't exist to the extent they were 20 years ago. You had your George Masons back then, but
Butler
even,
you know, for the 2-year run they had.
Right, but
with their 3,000 students.
Right, and it's just different. So I think, you know, 20 years ago, there was probably 80 competitive college basketball teams. Now there's like 120.
Yeah.
It is just ridiculous. And I mean, you look at Loyola Chicago, that entire Atlantic 10 conference, you know, with Dayton, all of those teams in there can compete with the best of teams. So I think that makes things difficult. But, you know, as far as not having a dominant team or a number one team, I think Carolina is a bit to blame for that. You know, not being
seriously
as good as they were as like, the AP number one team.
How do you play in the national championship game? You're winning at halftime. And then the very next year, you return every single player and you're just not. You're not good. Like, how does that happen?
I think another difficult thing is, for parity's sake, it's like Duke and Carolina could have some really dominant teams because they would recruit good players, and then Christian Laettner stayed for 4 years. Now it's like you get those so many one and dones. There's this weird mix where like Carolina and Duke are like fringe top 25 teams, and Carolina's a top or a fringe tournament team, and you have teams like Purdue who, you know, Zeki's going to be there for 3 more years or whatever the circumstance might be, 2 more years. And they can be really good for a lot of time, but they're not as talented as Duke and Carolina because they don't have those NBA, you know, type of talented players. So it's like a weird mix of not having one dominant team, but like an entire slew of like 20, 25 really good teams.
Do you think Clemson makes the tournament?
I don't know. you know, I think if they, it'll be interesting to see what happens. They'll probably have to win a couple of games in the ACC tournament, but they'll have a good seed, probably finish third or fourth in the conference would be my guess. And so we'll only have to win three games to win the ACC tournament, but yeah, I don't know.
Last question on the college basketball before we switch. Give me a dark horse. Just any team that's probably not one of the top three, is not going to be a three seed, top three seed in their region. What team do you think can, let's say, 4, 5, 6, 7 can make a deep run in come tournament time?
I would probably go with an ACC team because I've watched a lot. I think Duke isn't getting as much attention as Duke typically gets. And they're a 7 seed, and like they haven't lost a home game in weeks, and they're a really talented team. The issue will be, like I've said this with Duke, it's like, do they have a guard that can step up and score for them consistently and make plays? Because you'll need that come tournament time. I think Miami, obviously, every single tournament year is always dangerous, especially with this core of talent. They're exactly like Alabama in the sense that they do have like 4 or 5 bona fide scorers that can step up for them at any time, and they'll be a 4 or 5 seed.
Yeah,
and they'll get totally disrespected, and I guarantee you will make a run to the Sweet 16, if not farther. So, I mean, if like people are like, oh, well, Miami's only a 4 seed. I wonder how that'll work. It's like, pick them. Just literally pick them. And I bet they go to the Sweet 16. Not kidding. That should be pretty much money in the bank. But you look at their talent, and they're just total scorers. It worked last year. I think it's going to work again. It'll be interesting to see how far they go. But that would probably be a couple of dark horse teams. I mean, it's tough. Like the Big Ten.
No, I know.
Like Northwestern.
Big Ten's going to get 10 teams in, and how good are
right, and it's like they're just not dangerous like tournament teams. Like, no. I look at Northwestern, and it's like they're so defensive based.
Exactly.
And
it's like
Virginia.
They're not going to have anybody score. So if they don't win a game 55-53, yeah, they're not winning.
It's tough. It's tough to win a lot of games.
And it feels
like
that's
that.
The entire Big Ten this right. year. It is, you know, outside of maybe Purdue and Indiana, there's no one guy, and maybe Michigan too, but like you can't really count on a guy to score 25 points.
I saw Maryland play a couple of times and they looked really good, but then they lose to Ohio State last night. Like, I don't know. I would throw them out there.
I am excited to see how the Big 12 tournament goes and who's able to win it, and then how they perform in the tournament, because I literally every statistical measure you look at, the Big 12 is far and away the best conference this year. And meanwhile, the Pac-12 doesn't exist. I don't know.
Arizona State looked good against Arizona.
They did. They got that huge three quarters court heave. To win that one, and now I believe their first Lenardi had them as their last team in. Yeah. So it goes to show you the thin razor's edge that you got to stand on if you're one of those bubble teams in college basketball. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the MLB. They've implemented in spring training the pitch clock. Mm-hmm. So far, the time of game has been cut drastically. Yes, it is spring training. We'll see how it affects actual games. But there was a clip circulating on Twitter of it was a spring training game, and it was an inning where the pitcher, I think it was the Pirates. I can't remember who they were playing. It was a Pirates pitcher. He pitched an entire inning in the same amount of time that it took. I think it was it a playoff game? The Cubs?
So. Cubs pitcher.
It was a Cubs somebody. It was a Cubs pitcher. And he pitched the entire inning in the same amount of time it took that pitcher to throw a single pitch.
Yep.
Do you think this is good for the game of baseball?
I think it's great for the game of baseball. It seems faster. It seems higher paced, and the tempo seems to be up. I mean, I don't see how that couldn't be a good thing. I mean, there are obviously going to be baseball purists who don't like it, and I've seen like codified baseball like being like, oh, you know, let's have them play less innings, you know, if you want to speed up the game, blah, 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 blah. But it's like, it's not the length of the game. It's the tempo. It's how quickly things are happening. It's like, as much as, you know, we love basking in baseball and just having it on and maybe, you know, doing your homework, it's like a lot of the common folk and common fan hate the, you know, one pitch, okay, you know, oh, nodding off the catcher 5 times, having him come up to the mound, discussing what pitch you want to throw, getting this. It's like, it gets tiring for fans. And I don't think it makes a huge difference, really, if at all, with like starting pitchers. They typically, you know, deal pretty quickly. The game just slows down to kind of a halt when relievers come in, and that's not going to be, you know, a thing anymore. And I think that's good. I think that there needs to be a couple of, you know, little added details in there. Like I would, you know, like how does it affect with rain and with bad weather?
That's
and,
a good point.
You know, guys trying to get new baseballs, and are you still, you know, willing to play with that same pace despite all of that? Like I saw a pitcher get a new baseball once and they like didn't reset the clock. It's like, okay, that's ridiculous. So they'll have to like probably put a few differences and make it so that it's a little bit more fair to everyone involved. But I still think it's I think it's really good for the game.
Speaking as, you know, a casual MLB fan, that's what I am. Listen, I'm going to be more inclined to watch a baseball game of the Tigers now because they're not a good team, A. But B, if I can watch them in 2 hours and 40 minutes as opposed to 3 hours and 20 minutes, I'm going to be more inclined to do so. And that was a little bit of an extreme range there. But
right.
I will more likely sit through that, especially when there's things constantly happening. Then right. I sit there and I'm waiting for, you know, a 1 or a 2-1 fastball that, you know, took 45 seconds to come to the conclusion.
I think it's more about like Joe Klatt said it the other day. It's like nobody cares about like the 3 added minutes mm-hmm. of college football, and I think he's right. Like it's totally. I don't think MLB is doing this because people are like, well, I'm gonna plot out 3 hours of my day so I can watch this game, but or I would plot out 2.5 hours of my day to watch this game, but if it was 3 hours, I don't have time for that. It's like no. It's a sort of thing like getting your attention.
Yeah.
Like you're watching a game and oh, this game is really high paced. They are getting through at bats. They're getting through innings. They're getting through whatever very quickly. I'm going to be more inclined to watch rather than okay, they've thrown one pitch since I've been watching. It's been a minute. Like, I'm going to change the channel.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. It's not about, oh, well, you know, we don't want people sitting here for 3.5 hours. If people are watching the whole time, why not? You know, I don't think...
I will say my thing about Klatt is that he is a spokesperson for Fox.
Right.
And so he's not going to...
That's true.
Like Fox's broadcasts are inherently bad just because there are so many commercials.
Yes.
And so I disagree with his point there. But I also agree with his point that, hey, maybe college football would be more exciting if after every single first down there wasn't a stop of the clock. You keep it rolling. And instead of, you know, you having eventually a 4-hour college football game, it's going to come down. Yes, they still need to get rid of commercials, but there is a problem with the actual game length happening. So I agree with you. I think this is good for baseball. And I think that baseball, for the most part, has made the right steps towards you know, kind of grasping the attention of the younger audience because that's where they lack is the young demographics. I will say I dislike very much the runner on second rule and how they decided to make that the rule going forward in extra innings. I understand why they did it, but to me it just feels weird and tacky to just have like
feels a bit gimmicky.
Exactly, but, yeah.
I do think it makes for some really exciting situations.
No, it absolutely does. I mean, because now you're going to need a special, and a lot of teams already have this, but now you're going to need a specialized guy in your bullpen to come in during those situations and only throw. Like, he has to strike out the batter because if you even put the ball in play, the guy's moving up to third, and all of a sudden it's there's a guy on third with one out.
Right.
You need to miss bats in those situations. And so I think that adds some. Did they also make the bases bigger?
I think so, and like they made it easier to steal bases. I think, and you only get so many pickoff attempts.
I do like that because, like, if you got a guy who's fast over on first, and you know he's going to steal the 5 pickoff attempts before we actually address the batter at the plate is just because all the home fans will boo, and it's like. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, we just don't need this.
Yeah.
He's going to steal, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, I was thinking about this because I'm getting into soccer now overseas, and there's so much talk about, like, mid-season tournaments with basketball. I would do it in baseball. I wouldn't do it in basketball.
Really?
I think basketball, there's way too much load management mm-hmm. and resting players and guys taking games off that those guys wouldn't play in it.
Unless, no, they absolutely wouldn't.
And because it's like... Like in basketball, everything is framed around your legacy, how many championships you've won, all of that stuff. So mid-season tournaments have pretty much zero impact on a team's legacy, on a player's legacy, I would be very surprised if players playing it. But MLB guys are going in and day out playing in 162-game seasons, and there's a casual nature to the regular season with how many games are played. Mm-hmm. In other words, when you're watching it, you don't feel like it's the end of the world if you lose one game or lose a couple of games. It's just like, eh, it is what it is. I think for soccer, the reason why they need those, why they've had those midseason tournaments for so long, is there is a strong group of teams in the mix that pretty much have zero chance of winning the Premier League, even going into the season, if they have a strong team. Like, after outside of the six or seven teams, there's been really one in a long time, Leicester City, who's had success in winning the Premier League. And so what they needed to do is be like, those teams need to have a purpose in what they're playing for after the first few months. So they add in those midseason tournaments, and a team like Aston Villa can be like, hey, we didn't come close to winning the league. We knew we wouldn't, but hey, we won the FA Cup. You know, it's a huge deal for us. Mm-hmm. It's a very successful season. In baseball, you have 10, 15 teams who budget-based alone have very little chance to win the World Series. I think they're going to play the games anyway with the monotony of baseball and the regular season and sending out your guys no matter what against whoever team it is. There isn't a ton of injury concerns, if at all. You know, the only real way that you get hurt very common is, oh, baseball hit me in the hand and I broke a finger or whatever the case may be. It's like, it's just not very common. I think an added whatever, FA Cup, you know, something mid-season tournament into baseball would go a long way for the 10, 15 teams that feel like we don't really have a chance at winning the World Series this year. And if that's the only way we can determine success, it's going to be a tough, you know, life as an Orioles fan, right? Like, or not even Orioles, but whoever the example, as a Pittsburgh Pirates fan.
I think the tough thing is with that, I get where you're coming from, but you, like, they don't even have owners that care enough. So yeah, like, so like, that's why they're not able to compete, because we see with San Diego, they're not the biggest market, but they're at least trying, and they're eventually going to have to pay for it, but they're trying now, which you're seeing that these other owners, I think, to me, it just comes back to put the salary cap.
Salary floor.
Not even a floor. I think if you put a cap, it's going to drive down the prices of some of these players. And so the smaller teams are going to be able to afford more of them, or at least to keep their guys rather than having to trade them to, you know, the Yankees, Dodgers.
True.
What else? So I you know, going back to the pitch clock, really like that that installation. College baseball is doing this weird thing now with where the batter steps out of the box or something. It's a strike. I think that's a little too much.
I think it's like if they take too long to get in the batter's box, maybe, or
it just seems like a really, really odd rule to put in place, but just
really trying to speed up the game.
Okay. Now we're gonna get to the NFL combine. So there's some stuff we have to talk about. The first thing, of course, we're gonna talk about is Jalen Carter. So where to start with this? If you didn't know, I don't know how you didn't know, after Georgia won the national championship, I think it was literally like 36 hours after it happened, Chandler LaCroix and I think it was Dominic Willock, so a Georgia staffer and a Georgia player, I think he was an offensive lineman, sophomore, died in a car accident early, I think it was early in the morning. So that was back in middle of January. Comes out yesterday, or when would this be when the podcast? 3 days ago on Tuesday, that Jalen Carter actually was involved in this situation, and that Chandler LaCroix and Carter might have been racing, or probably were racing, excessive speeds over 100 miles per hour. And when LaCroix crashed her car, Carter drove away and then lied to, or not, I think the word was misled police about allegedly misled police about, you know, all his whereabouts.
Allegedly.
And
just put a big old...
And, you know, what actually happened. Now, LaCroix's BAC level was a 0.197. So if Carter was with them, allegedly with them, there's a good chance that he was also drinking and driving. It's not one of the charges.
Allegedly.
Charges. Yes, that's why I said allegedly. Not one of the charges brought against him. I believe there was two misdemeanor charges. I can't remember exactly off the top of my head what they were. Each one of them carries a maximum $1,000 fine, like I think it was like 100 hours of community service or something along, 1,000 hours. No, it was 100 hours of community service. And then, you know, some possible jail time. You know, obviously with the combine right around the corner, he was in Indy for the combine. He flies back to Athens, Georgia last night, makes a statement, does some stuff there, or he turns himself in. He posts his bail, I think it was $4,000. He's back in Indy Thursday to go through the combine and do interviews and measurements. I don't think the plan was never for him to actually do anything in the combine. So he's not running, he's not testing, he's not doing any on-field drills. You know, but there are some serious questions now about Jalen Carter. And there was the report, you know, a couple, I think it was about a month ago, right? Was the character concern? Was that in December? Was that before? I can't remember when that was. There were some reports about character concerns. And, you know, when it happened, it was all like, we heard all these great stories about Jalen Carter and you know, this that is stuff that he did. And then this comes out and it throws into question all of this stuff you thought you knew about Jalen Carter in a situation that, you know, we really don't want to make Jalen Carter the topic of discussion. But unfortunately, with the way things have played out, he is. And so I want to ask you, Obert, you know, what do you make of the situation? What do you think happens to Jalen Carter?
I don't know. He's charged with two misdemeanors, and that is a big, like, it's not like, oh, he's going to prison. Like, I would be surprised. It'll depend on, you know, how everything goes, but I would be surprised if he faces serious jail time. I don't know all of the facts. I really haven't looked at it, so, but it's a bad look, absolutely, and I think it will affect his draft stock. And, you know, I don't know enough to, you know, put a blank, you know, put the flag in the ground and be like, yeah, he's definitely in the wrong, or oh, he's totally innocent. But it's a bad look, and I'm sure it will affect his draft stock. And I think more than that, it'll affect how teams position around, because, you know, the asking price for the Colts to jump from 4 to 1, like, it probably was, oh, well, you give us this and this and then we can stay there and get Will Anderson Jr. and Jalen Carter. But if, you know, teams feel like, well, we don't like him as much as, you know, we used to because of character concerns or whatever the issue might be, that asking price is going to hike up a lot. The consolation prize of going from 1 to 4 is a lot worse than maybe it was.
It's now Tyree Wilson instead of Jalen Carter or Will Anderson.
True. So I don't know. I don't know what the situation is there, but that'll probably hurt some teams and affect that. I think it's a good sign that he's coming back to the combine and kind of ready to face the music. And
yeah, I mean,
he swears by his innocence.
Yeah, he made a statement. I forgot to mention that he made a statement yesterday, put it out on Twitter. He denies all the allegations. I think it was
of criminal wrongdoing.
Yeah. I think the rough words were, the events that took place have been, you know, grossly. It was like misconstrued or something along those lines.
Yep.
You know, it's tough because we need to see how it plays out. Hopefully, you know, it's a little bit of an expedited trial, so that we can have some more clarity on the situation, because, you know, there are some current concerns now, that he might not be available for, spring training if he does serve jail time. I don't think he will, but there is the possibility of that. And, you know, the question also has to be asked, why did he lie to the police? Why didn't he? And Ian Rappaport said today, none of the teams that he interviewed, he didn't say, mention any about it. So he's been talking to teams already. Nobody said any, or he didn't say anything about this, you know, prior to the report coming out. Why not? So it's one of those things where, you know, it's not a great look for him. But if you were a GM, you know, would you still say you were, say we're the Lions at 6. Are you still taking him?
Yeah, I am. I think there are just so many examples of, in football especially, it's like
Laremy Tunsil. He fell what I think eventually 12 spots because there was a picture of him smoking out of a bong,
right,
on Instagram.
If you trust his character, you trust, you know, what he tells you in these meetings, and you trust that, you know, he is a really great person and all stuff like that, you're going to take him, and a team will take him. The point being, these, you know, NFL GMs aren't the jury and executioner. They're not. We can say, oh, well, it's immoral and this behavior shouldn't be rewarded. We can say all of that. The truth and fact is these GMs are paid to win Super Bowls. Yep. They are paid to win and compete at the highest level. They are willing to do whatever it takes to do so, or a lot of what it takes to do so. And if that includes, you know, trusting Jalen Carter, whether or not you think that is right or wrong, to, you know, lead your D-line or whatever the you know, purpose is, it's going to happen. And if it's not the Lions, it's going to be a different team. And so really what it comes down to is, do the character concerns, or if you don't have any, does this incident, you know, take him from going from a really good prospect to just a, you know, pretty good or great prospect to a really good one? How does it affect it? If it doesn't, then yeah, you'll absolutely take him at six. But the point of, should we take him or not, is this, are these charges, you know, making it so that it is unjustifiable to take him? Nobody is going to feel that way. Nobody is going to say he's off our board, we can't take this guy. That would be, I mean, because there is going to be a team that takes him. Maybe a couple of teams say, oh, he's off our board, we're not going to take him.
Yeah.
But 95% of these teams, if Carter's in the second round, are you kidding me? They'll take him. So... yeah, I think it's a matter of if, not when, he gets taken, and I would assume it would still be in the top five picks. I really believe that. It'll be interesting to see, but we've seen a lot of players do a lot worse, and, you know, kind of not get rewarded, but their behavior kind of be like, eh,
yeah,
it's not a huge deal. I mean, look at, I mean, Deshaun Watson, whatever you want to say about it, it's like we traded a lot of ammunition to get that guy, you know, and so I would be surprised if he goes outside of the top five.
Yeah, for a situation like this, if you feel comfortable, you know, with what he tells you, you have to take him. He is of that caliber of player. We saw what happened with Laremy Tunsil. It was the biggest mistake for the teams ahead of them, right, to let the Dolphins get him for essentially nothing. I mean, yeah, you're talking about getting the best. I think he was, at the time, prospect-wise, the best, like everybody was like, yeah, he's the number one prospect in this class. And he falls to 13, and it's like, it was literally just a picture. Turns out, you know, hey guys, players smoke weed. Right. It's crazy. And he comes out and is one of the best tackles in football. You know, if you have an opportunity to take a guy like Jalen Carter, and he does pass your character, you know, test, I think you have to take him.
Yep.
Because somebody's going to.
Wouldn't you be surprised if he didn't get picked like five, four?
Listen, I mean, if I'm the Seahawks and sitting there at five and the four teams ahead of me didn't take him, I'm absolutely taking him.
They're going to need a D tackle. You don't think they take Jalen Carter?
Exactly.
I would be stunned.
Listen, if I'm the Bears and nobody wants to trade with me, I'm still taking him at one.
Wow.
I am. Like, he's, like, as long as he's not
serving. But I would have taken Will Anderson Jr. regardless.
As long as he's not, you know, serving 5 years in prison, right, and he's available for you. Because, like, we've seen it with other players before. You know, Tyreek Hill, Adrian Peterson.
Yep.
Like, as much as you hate it, it's the GM's jobs to put together a great winning team. It's not the GM's jobs to put a team together of high character people. So... Jalen Carter.
They say it is. You know, they'll go on and be like, oh, well, yeah, we love these guys. Oh, yeah, we interviewed him. We think he is the best person, you know, that we could have taken. And it's like, this is all, you know, politics. It's,
I will say, you know, that their job becomes easier if they don't have to worry about,
right,
about that person. But, you know, Vontaze Burfict and Pac-Man Jones were in the league for a long time, right, and those are two of the worst people that you could possibly, like, they're just not good people.
Dirty players.
And they were in the league for, you know, it's 8-9 years.
Burfict was a headhunter.
Exactly. So you can't tell me that, yes, it's a bad look, but you can't tell me.
Allegedly.
That, no, it's no matter what it is.
It's perfect. Was ahead on that. Oh,
okay. So only one quarterback of the, you know, top, I believe top four, because Hendon Hooker, I don't even think he's able to throw, isn't throwing, and it's Bryce Young. What do you make of the decision for him to not throw at the combine, rather wait until the pro day?
You know, I wouldn't really penalize him, folks. So many other quarterbacks said, oh, I'm not playing in my bowl game, blah, 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 blah. Yep. He did. He played in his bowl game, showed up, showed out, did fantastic. If he doesn't want to throw at the combine, you don't have to throw at the combine. I'm almost, like, I would rather guys compete at the combine and do everything like that, but versus like a bowl game, it's not even close to me. I mean, the combine is a thing. It's in Indianapolis. It's
they're
not
in their pajamas.
Through your school. Yeah, you're in your pajamas. If you don't want to run and compete because you feel like, hey, I'm not feeling great or whatever the circumstance might be, you don't have to. You know, I mean,
yeah.
So it's not a huge deal to me. And Bryce Young probably is interviewed with a couple of teams,
yeah.
And he knows that's the important thing. And if a team is telling him, hey, you know, we're going to trade up to one and get you, what is his incentive to throw at the combine or do anything like that? So I really don't think, guys, especially if you're like a high draft pick, like what do you have to, you know, play at the combine or compete at the combine for? So don't really blame him. But, you know, could he lose ground to a guy like C.J. Stroud who throws at the combine and is fantastic? It's like, yeah, he could, you know, and that could affect it. But I wouldn't like, oh, he's this. He's not playing at or not throwing at the combine. He's down a peg. Like, no, I don't feel that way at all. Again, could lose ground. Absolutely could if other guys do fantastic and he just hadn't thrown and we're like, okay, well, sorry, but that's how it is. So we'll see. But as it is, like, no, I would not definitely move him down. But like I said,
yeah,
C.J. Stroud could, you know, show up.
Yeah, and I think for especially for Stroud and Young, it's almost like just look at our tape. Like, right, yeah. Just watch what we did in the football game. So that is good enough to the point where we shouldn't have to throw against air for you to see that. Hey, I'm capable. Like they made better throws, the C.J. Stroud throw to Marvin Harrison on the corner route against Michigan. Like that throw is good enough for me to be like, yeah, you don't have to throw at the combine because I know what you're capable of. For guys like Will Levis and Anthony Richardson, who the big question is ball placement and accuracy, throwing on air is probably the best thing that you could do for your stock. So yeah, no, I agree with you. I just thought it was. I thought it was interesting. I think Bryce Young, for him, the combine is about his measurables. It's about It's about how much he's going to weigh, and it's about getting in the room to interview with these front offices and head coaches and be like, hey, you know, this is who I am as a person. This is who I am as a player. My 196-pound frame, you know, doesn't mean that I can't compete.
He weighed in at 196?
NFL. I have no idea. Oh, okay. We won't find out until tomorrow, Saturday.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
Tomorrow.
I bet it'll be around there. Yeah, probably. He said, might tack on a lot.
They said he's close to
195.
The close to 200.
Wow.
And okay. Nobody expects him to be exactly at 200, but they think he can be close.
Yeah.
Which for him is probably the best news he could get because, you know, when he's playing in the NFL, like in season, he'll probably weigh as much as 188.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's. Oh,
yeah. That's what Mel Kiper said. He was like, yeah, the big number for me is 195. If he's over 195, you know, green flag, but otherwise it could be a problem. And he's like, obviously he's tacking on a bunch of lbs and he's getting heavier, but he's probably going to be, like you said,
it's 185 cause in the playing, season. Playing weight in season is so much different than your off-season weight, right. or whatnot, because when your body takes the hits that it does during the season, you still lift, but you more so lift for recovery and trying to maintain that strength. You're not getting stronger. You're losing weight. And guys talk about this all the time. You know, you come in the season at, you know, 225. You end the season at 218, 215. It's like, it's just the natural progression of how the game is played. I agree with Mo. If he crosses that 195 threshold, I'll feel pretty good about it. If he's under that, this now becomes a serious concern. Last question. Because I've seen it on Twitter. Dan Campbell made a point about it yesterday, but he was more so talking about the agility drills and stuff like that. You know, what do you take away from the combine? Because you watch the guy's tape. You watch him throughout the college football season. And then you see him on this field where there's no other football players where they're doing a lot of agility work, you know, 40, 5'10", 5 vertical, broad jump. You know, what kind of percentage do you give the combine as opposed to the tape?
I don't know if there's a direct number to it. I think it is context for the tape oftentimes
I completely agree.
You watch a tape and you're like, oh, well, like with Chris Olave last year, like going back to last year, I was like, this is a 4.45 guy that he's not a great athlete, but you know, he's a great route runner, gets open, catches the ball well, good contested catch guy. And then he comes in and runs a 4.38 and you're like, I didn't see that. That's interesting. So that's really what it is. Make it simple, it is just purely testing athletic traits. That's exactly what it's for, and that's exactly what it is. You can say, oh, those drills are interesting, though, because it doesn't really. If you're really buying into those drills where, you know, with D-lineman, it's like the football on a stick drill, like watch a tape. Just, you know, turn on their playing, how they play, and that'll probably give you better context and show you what you're looking for. But truly, I think it's about the athletic traits and how those factor in. But obviously, you see, you know, how guys are athletically on film and how they look in highlights and whatever the circumstance may be. The only difference is this gives you pure, you know, numbers that don't lie.
Yeah.
So it basically tells you, okay, this guy seems a bit slow, or this guy, it basically confirms all of your beliefs about their athletic abilities, but it purely tests athletic abilities. Obviously, you can see some of athletics on film, but oftentimes you can't know for sure because it can be like I said last year with Chris Olave, like that was the one that surprised me. I thought he was more of like a high 4.4s guy, not a great athlete, and then he tests at like 4.38 or something like that. So it just kind of shows you exactly what athletically those guys are and what does that mean. Why is that important? Mm-hmm. Because then you can know, okay, what is this guy's specific potential? That is where, you know, like, it is athletics. Athletics, you know, potential comes from your athleticism. It's true. You can be as great of technique as you possibly want. I can't play in the NFL. I can't. You know, I'm a great athlete, but I'm not of the elite class. No, I'm just kidding. But there's a reason why they test for things. And I think it's kind of ridiculous to just throw it out all out the window and be like, no, I'm only watching the tape. I'm only watching the tape. Well, you're watching the tape and you're seeing that these guys are slow. Like, there's a reason why Luka Garza, you know, in college basketball didn't exactly translate to the NBA. It's like, you can just see that on tape, but it's like,
I think
athleticism is important. Athleticism is important.
I think you could see that on tape with him. He could not move at all.
Right.
You know, I agree with you. To me, you use the combine to either confirm or question what you had seen on tape. The example that I like to go back to is a guy like, you know, Tyquan Thornton, who, you know, when you watch him at Baylor, it's like you can see the long speed, but it doesn't really show up, you know, play after play after play when he was at Baylor. But when you look at a guy like Tyreek Hill play, like his speed shows up on tape, and he's what people would call a true 4.2 player or whatever it is. He's going to run that in the 40, and then he's going to run that on the football field too. Whereas a guy like Tyquan Thornton, I think he ran a 4.24 or something crazy like that in the 40. But when he gets on the field, it's more of like a 4.33 because he's not exactly, you know, great in and out of cuts.
Who was that? Sorry.
Tyquan Thornton.
Okay.
So, you know, for me, it's almost, there's certain drills that I really look for, more so than others in the combine. Broad jump and vertical are two things, just because that's a good measurement of really what your explosiveness is. Because you can kind of see it on tape, but for certain guys, like, you know, like a Byron Jones, who had the 12.3 broad jump, like for a corner, like you can see that he's got the explosiveness. So when he's breaking out of cuts, you know the power is going to be there. Whereas the 40s, you know, I don't really care about your straight line speed. I can see how fast you are on tape. If you have a good amount of tape where you are in the open field, you know, but some of the other stuff, the 5.10.5, you know, how quickly can you get out of cuts, or even the three cone, that almost too, because it shows you the bend around corners. But like the on-field drills, like I don't know if I care all that much about those, just because I can see what you did on tape. Now, for certain guys who you weren't able to, you know, either watch a ton of tape of or didn't play a ton, that might be good. But like a guy like Aiden Hutchinson, I didn't need to see him do those drills to know that he was a good athlete. Like, yeah. I saw it on tape at Michigan. So, and I also think that, you know, the combine leads you in a false sense of, not even a false sense, but gives you like Trayvon Walker. Like, he wasn't even talked about as a first round guy. And then the combine shows up and all of a sudden, you know, you get the measurables, you see the athletic testing numbers, and he's the number one overall pick. I don't think he was the best player in the class last year.
Yeah.
And I don't think he will be when we look at this class 6-7 years down the road. But you'll always have those combine risers, and it's really, you know, the traits are there. Can we build on this, you know, with development? Anthony Richardson's one of those guys this year. He's going to blow the doors. I would be surprised if he got anything less than a 9.9 on his RAS score. You know, for him, it's not about that, though. It's about, you know, can he make the progression and development on the field to be an elite-level quarterback? You know, you look at the traits, and we talk about this. What does this guy give me?
Yep.
That's what the combine's for. What does this guy give me? But you also got to see it translate to the field. So, I don't know. If I had to, I would say like 80-20, you know, in terms of tape combine. I think the combine, especially for, you know, the coaches and GMs that are there, it's more so that they can talk to these guys.
Right.
Like, they don't really care what happens on the field. Some of it, some of the guys, they do.
Unless it's a shock.
Exactly, exactly.
And there's always a degree of the combine is more important for some guys than others. You know, if, if you're like Jackson Smith and Jigba, you start running the 40 because people are saying he's going to run a 4.6. His 40 time is more important than probably any other wide receivers in the class. It is vital that he runs in that, you know, 4.5, 4.4 number so that it's not a red flag. You don't think he's going to?
No, I saw high 4.5s is what people think he's going to run. And you know what? For him, I don't necessarily care. He's a slot receiver. That's what you're drafting him for. I don't need my slot receiver to have 4.3 speed.
Yep.
I need him to be able to get in and out of cuts, which we've seen him be able to do at Ohio State. I would like him to, I don't know if he's participating in the other athletic drills, but I'd like to see what his shuttle is, what his three cone is. Just because, you know, I saw that on tape. Yeah, sure, like you mentioned, the acceleration isn't there. Like his 10-yard split would probably be crap just because he just doesn't have that acceleration. 2. I don't care.
8 seconds.
If I'm Jesus. If I'm drafting maybe a slot receiver, like, to me that doesn't matter. You know, whereas if I'm drafting an X or a Z, it's like, I want you to be able to get out quickly. You know, like when you're talking about Quentin Johnston, like he's gonna need to run a 4.4 for me to be like, yeah, because, you know, kind of Calvin Johnson-like numbers.
Yep.
Just because he is going to be that guy, I need you to be fast on the outside. I can't have you running a 4.6 because he's not a good possession receiver.
Yep.
You know, what do you give me? So, yeah.
He's going to give you 4.3.
I think he might. Seriously, that dude is fast, and that's one of the things that I keep getting hung up on, which is why I wanted to push the wide receivers because I still don't. I want to see what he does at the combine before I make a decision on him. We'll start having more draft stuff coming back out after the combine. We'll finally have all those numbers. We'll be able to make, you know, a little bit more of comprehensive lists. There's going to be risers. There's going to be fallers. So I'm very intrigued to see how this weekend goes. You good?
Yep.
Thank you guys so much for watching. Hope you enjoyed. Catch you on the flip. See ya.